Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by Jeremy Goldcorn, man behind Danwei.com. How is it going, Jeremy?
A very good evening to you, Kaiser.
Today, we're also joined by Cynical regular David Moser, a true polymath, whose day job is as Academic Director of Chinese Studies at Beijing CET. Great to have you back on Cynical, David.
Thank you. I'm not a polymath. I'm very bad at math.
Well, poly at everything but math. And we are also delighted to welcome back Didi Kirsten Tatlow, correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, who was just on last week's show, the All Cynical Federation of Women, the episode where she just killed. She was great. And so I thought I just had to have her back on Cynical and for a very topic that she's deeply read on and has written on extensively. Really glad you could join us again, Didi.
Thank you, Kaiser.
Let me quickly remind everyone to please jump on Facebook and like our page at facebook.com/CynicaPodcast, where there's often very lively discussion on the topics that we discuss here on Cynica. So today, we devote the episode to one of the big, big issues in contemporary Chinese life, that is the crisis of ethics, morality, and civic consciousness. So please settle in for what may be an unusually long episode because there's an awful lot to talk about here. This is something we've touched on in many shows in the past. We talked about the tragic fate of Xiaoyue, the four-year-old girl, Wang Yue, who was run over not once but twice by minivans in Guangzhou while no one lifted a finger to help her. For example, we've also talked about professional ethics among Chinese journalists on a recent episode about pay for play and the practice of giving red envelopes to journalists just to get them to attend your boring press conference. We've also talked about official corruption in many occasions, and these are all manifestations of the topic, of course, but today we want to dig in deeper on the issue. Is there really a crisis? If so, what are its root causes? What's the Communist Party doing in an effort to address this, the precipitous decline of civic consciousness and of morality, beyond occasionally hauling out of Lei Feng or trying to revive old Confucius? What is being taught right now in Chinese schools? What's the role of belief systems, from largely secular ones like Confucianism to religions like Buddhism, Islam, or more recently Christianity? How does this play into the efforts to address the issue? So David and Didi, as I said, have both thought a great deal about these issues, as I'm sure Jeremy has and I have a bit. Let's start the issues of civic consciousness, of morality, ethics. It's raised in the public discourse with increasing frequency, I think, in recent years. Just in the last few weeks here, it's been very much on the minds of netizens, at least, who've watched, for instance, the videos of a young American guy sharing his fries with a beggar woman, who've read about a Uruguayan woman who dived into West Lake to save a drowning woman, the Brazilian guy who was beaten by thieves after he tried to stop a purse snatcher in Dunguan. What else was there? Just the other day we had Jeremy, was it the driver named Ubin? Where was that?
Can't remember what? A bus driver who was struck by a piece of
flying
shrapnel of some kind and managed to pilot the bus to safety on the shoulder of the road before expiring himself.
Right. He actually managed to get everyone safely off the bus.
Right, before he died.
So, these sorts of acts of heroism. The effect of all of these things has been to send everyone into sort of paroxysms of self-examination and trying to figure out what is wrong with us Chinese people. Let's start with a very basic question. Where did this start? What's the root of it? Is it enough to just sort of blithely say that the collapse of Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought left a moral vacuum in China? I mean, does it really? Does this decline date to the beginning of opening and reform? Or can we, take it further back to, say, the Cultural Revolution, or even maybe further back to the May 4th New Culture Movement, the cultural iconoclasm there? What are your thoughts on that, David, maybe?
Well, it does go way back. I think even back as far as Lu Xun, was sitting over in Japan looking at his own country and was lamenting the fact that public behavior was so terrible and the Chinese seemed from the outside, to be, especially in the public sphere, to be lacking in the usual kinds of compassion that you would see overseas. And it's come up again and again. I've heard the Mao era being blamed, or the Cultural Revolution for wiping out the sort of intrinsic civic mindedness and politeness of Beijing society and Chinese society in general. You know, it's sort of an ongoing thing. I think Weibo has exacerbated it because people see it firsthand.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So maybe it's being brought to our attention more because little instances of either really iniquitous behavior of you know sort of barbarous callousness or of heroism are now brought to everyone's attention.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, that's definitely true. It's interesting because you talk about you know the Mao era. I mean, my experiences being born and raised in Hong Kong, it was very common for people to talk about similar situations, such as there'd be a robbery on a bus or something, and nobody reacted. Now, of course, Hong Kong is has never experienced Communist Party rule. So I often think that there's something much, much deeper going on than that, too, as you, in yeah. fact, suggested, of course, that there is. But what that actually is, how you unpick that,
yeah.
it's a very complex topic.
When I was at Peking University in the 1980s, the intellectuals there on campus, and we would bring these things up, you know, because the big topic was what's wrong with China. That's always what it comes to, you know, when they get a little bit drunk. And one thing they said to me a lot was, I think China really needs a religion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a good one would be Christianity because it has lots of positive features. And I would say, well, are you inclined to believe in, or do you believe in Christianity? And they would say, oh, no, of course not. No, I'm totally a scientific rationalist. But I think the average Chinese people, they need something like religion to pull them out of this, you know, sort of selfish.
You don't know how familiar this sounds. I mean, I've heard this countless times yeah. myself. Jeremy, you've probably
all
heard.
Kinds of people.
yeah. Right, right.
And it's really striking how many lawyers here who are fighting for what they believe is a public good and certainly fighting for rule of law, democracy, etc., are Christian.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. How many? We can name quite a few of the Yujia. Chai Ling, if you want to.
I mean, yeah, she left quite a while ago now. I mean, but even today, people look, who are not I mean, explicit
sorry,
lawyers.
I just have to have a quick word about Chai Ling. This is the most appalling individual.
Sure.
I mean, this is somebody who, you know.
But careful, she's going to sue you for
well, not. She's appalling.
No, she'll forgive you now, actually.
Oh, she'll forgive. I don't, yeah. you know, I think know she has no moral weight.
Standing.
She has no moral standing.
Right.
She has nothing
to say. I also wouldn't pick Chai Ling
as an
example.
I was going to recommend her book tonight. And Jeremy, you blew it. Darn it. I have to come up with another recommendation.
Well, let's not just make this into ripping on Chai Ling. But I mean, there are certainly, I mean, Bob Fu, who was instrumental in helping in Chen Guangcheng's escape.
Yeah.
But there are also a lot of much quieter individuals, not the Bob Fus and the Chai Lings of this world, but, you know, people who you question them. And I remember recently interviewing a woman who was a similar, an incredibly brave person who's fighting for independent elections. Mm-hmm. And I, in fact, mentioned her last week, I believe. But I said to her, well, how do you actually find the strength to face up to this? Because, you know, it's not just the moments that we hear about where she's beaten up by various thugs hired by the government, for example, beaten to the ground. But it's the days and the nights where nothing much seems to be happening, where she's actually dealing with herself, with her family, with her conscience, with her life. And we don't see a lot about that. And her answer perhaps shouldn't have surprised me, but it always does, was, I have God.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yeah. What, as a Western sort of rationalist, if you like, what's your response? One's response to that? It's quite challenging, actually.
That that's not just China, though. I mean, I saw a really interesting motivational video a couple of months ago on YouTube. It's this Australian guy who has no legs and no hands, and he's a very good motivational speaker because basically he's got this body that is. You know, just
they show that video in the churches here in Beijing, in the big Catholic churches.
Well, right.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's very convincing motivational speaker. I mean, this guy with no legs and no hands can have a happy life. You know, whatever's wrong with your life, it can't be as bad as his. So why not? But then he gets to the God part, which, you know, at which part he lost me. But it seems to me that, you know, it's really a bit of a logical problem. I mean, quite clearly, this is one person who should not believe in God.
Yeah. Right. I mean, because God seems to hate amputees.
Because God obviously thinks.
He hates amputees. He never grows back their limbs.
Yeah, he never grows back
their
limbs.
Cure the blind. Or,
but you know, you say, you know, that I certainly agree with you. I mean, but I think some of our feelings about Christianity are, you know, based upon our personal experiences with it in other countries. The Chinese, I don't know about the people that you have interviewed, and I don't even know if, for example, Liu Xiaobo has Christian leanings or something.
He's very interested in Christianity. He's not a practicing Christian, as far
as
I know.
But the point is that in the Chinese context, they take Christianity sort of like Westerners adopt, you know, Buddhism or Taoism. They treat it like a smorgasbord. They take a little bit of this and that. They don't take it, all of the aspects, especially the doctrinal aspects that we find irrational or something. You know, they'll just say, I just believe there's this force and, you know, that God will help me. And so very often it's kind of a very trimmed down, basic form of Christianity that's no more than a kind of spiritualism.
I think this is a very interesting point, because it also suggests that when you take a religion and transpose it to a different culture,
right,
you're in a better position to pick and choose.
That's right.
And that's a very, very interesting phenomenon, because I think it also suggests that religion is about spirituality. And that is a very personal thing, and it's embedded in yourself and your mind and your body as well.
Don't you think that, I mean, for me, if Christianity has an appeal in China, it should be the two following things. One, there are rules, you know, Ten Commandments style. They're things that you just don't do because it's wrong.
Even though most of them have to do with God's personal vanity.
Well, you take the good ones, okay, right. Forget about the bad ones, but don't kill, don't steal, don't
That's
cheat
about
on your
all
wife,
you got,
those
right.
ones. And number two, even though there are rules, you should be forgiving of people.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't those the two most interesting things about Christianity in terms of using it as a value system?
Yeah, but my impression is that they don't adopt the first one especially, that they don't put an emphasis on that. That like Buddhism and Christianity, what a lot of these people are looking for is some kind of solace. I mean, there's a lot of pain to live in China, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And a lot of the people I see, when you ask them things like that, they're not talking about, you know, sort of stringent moral codes. They're talking about release from suffering and you know, lifting burdens off their soul.
Well, if we want to talk about release from suffering, isn't there a perfectly good, you know, not purely indigenous, of course, it was also an import, but a religion with a hell of a lot more of a track
Which is
record,
Buddhism.
Which is, of course, Buddhism,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And why?
Well,
My sense is actually, I mean, while we may focus on the Christians, I mean, what I see more and more are people with the outsized Buddhist prayer beads and with the Bodhisattva Guanyin hanging from
I think that's true, but, you know, Buddhism is, I mean, there are lots of different kinds of Buddhism, and what I see is a lot of people, I don't mean to underestimate people's devotion and genuine interest when they have it, but I also see a lot of people who are quite instrumental in their approach, particularly to Buddhism, you know, pray for something, for example, pray for this, pray for that.
Mm.
And it's about accumulation of some kind. I think there's a fair amount of that going on too.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. I mean, there's, you know, this isn't in just China. I mean, there was that whole Nam-myoho Renge Kyo cult in what was it called?
In
NSA
Japan.
Or something like that. Oh, no, it spread to California. In fact, I at one point had a roommate who was, you know, chanting this and asking for a VCR whatever it was.
But Buddhism is an interesting example. I mean, there's a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that the Buddhist revival, at least the number of people who self-report as Buddhists, is enormous and dwarfs Christianity. And I just recently did a paper on this of these what you could call the weakened Buddhists or the urban Buddhists, the ones who don't really frequent the temples and they don't really necessarily have any, you know, ritual associated with it. But as you say, Kaiser, they're wearing the beads, the four jewel.
And they're rich enough, they know a living Buddha who they occasionally
Yeah, they have a
bring
master,
to cocktail parties.
The Buddha they may associate with. And these people are you know, an enormous group of people who are sort of invisible. And as you say, you know, if you ask them, there are many reasons. I mean, the ones who are more sort of hardcore that actually go to the temples, in fact, they are praying for things like cures for diseases and things like that. It's sort of similar to evangelical Christianity. But the others are more like lifestyle Buddhists. They may or may not meditate. They may or may not be vegetarians. They just pick and choose what they want, and it gives them some solace. Sometimes they just say, you know, this helps me get through. I had a cab ride, and the cabbie was wearing the four jewel on his wrist. I was listening to, you know, Nami Amitofo, Amitofo, on the cab. And I said, are you a Buddhist? And he says, oh, yeah. And I couldn't believe this of that demographic. Someone that adopting Buddhism, it was, in my experience, is very unusual, but I think it's becoming more and more common.
I think it's becoming definitely more common. And to relate this back to the bigger moral question of how are you moral in a state like this, by which I mean China today, you know, I think that's very interesting, because how do you actually create a coherent, meaningful sense of religion? Well, you need to talk about it publicly. And, of course, people are starting to talk about it, but there are still enormous restrictions on what can be taught and what can be discussed in the academies and the universities, even in public, even on TV. And, you know, how then do you actually get to the point where you're creating something that makes sense, that's actually meaningful, that's worthwhile, that provides some kind of social guide, some standard of ethics and morals? That's still, I think, a huge challenge here. And I think you're seeing a lot of fairly crazy stuff coming out as a result, as people sort of discover religion but can't really go into it very deeply or very meaningfully. Just want to give a very swift example. Last weekend was International Children's Day, and on that day, a bunch of people from Beijing, over 10 or so, decided to release some wild animals, mm-hmm. which, you know, you win sort of win brownie points for in Buddhism if you buy
it's
animals.
Feng sheng,
exactly. Yeah. And you release them into the wild. It means literally let go of life. Mm-hmm. And they went to a snake market in eastern Beijing and bought apparently an enormous, like several hundreds kilos of snakes and released them into a village just outside Beijing to the complete consternation of the villagers who've now spent 6 days killing snakes because their homes are overrun with snakes. They don't know what kinds of snakes they are. They don't know if they're poisonous or not. There are short ones, long ones, thin ones, fat ones. I mean, it's just chaos. And they ended up having to pay the villagers 40,000 renminbi in reparations for their kind of snake dump. I mean, and you just wonder what's that about? What's the meaning there?
I think the meaning is this, that these people who think that religion is a good idea for China are completely whack. Because this is what basically happens with religion in China. It's not
possible.
Really instilling some kind of moral system. So these Buddhists go to the snake market where the snakes are abused, and they stimulate demand for illegal snake trafficking by, you know, and then this whole thing plays out. I mean, you know, this is not a moral thing. This is Vladimir Nabokov talked about, he hated Freud and he hated psychology. And he used to talk about Freudianism as being people who had some kind of problem.
He talked about children spying on their parents.
Well, what he actually, he had one specific phrase, which was that if you want to take a bunch of old Greek myths and rub them on your genitals in order to stop the itching, that's fine with you. But it's not going to solve anything. And I mean, this to me seems to be what you see with Christianity, Buddhism, Taoism now in China. It's just a bunch of old stories that people are rubbing onto their
genitals.
Right, I agree.
Their
it gives them
sometimes.
Some relief.
It gives them some relief.
However, I think
it's not solving any moral problems.
Yeah, I think we've isolated the problem here, that it does seem to be sort of this personal salve for rather than some sort of coherent moral framework, which is really what I think we would all agree is the actual missing piece here.
Right.
Well, now, we talk about this moral vacuum since the sort of hollowing out of Marxism-Leninism, but that sort of posits that Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, was itself some sort of a cohesive moral system, that it helped to govern behavior. Was it that, or was it just merely sort of an authoritarian enforcement of laws? Did it really...
Well, a lot of it has been written about the fact that Maoism was in a certain sense a cult. It was a religious movement, and the people responded to it religiously. I mean, there are even tales of people, you know, believing that something that had been touched by Mao could cure diseases and this kind of thing.
Sure, sure. Right? But that wasn't so commonplace now, was it?
Well, I don't know. I mean the you see the adoration in Tiananmen Square of the Red Guard. I mean, there was something very much religious.
And there
about
is the famous story of the holy mango.
Yes.
That they put a mango in a glass box, very much like a religious relic.
Yeah.
And this was then transported around the country. I mean, there was absolutely a highly religious dimension.
When he gave mangoes
to the
squabbling factions at Peking University.
And the
interesting thing about Maoism and Marx, you know, sort of Marxism-Leninism as he practiced it, was that it was rather empty of any moral content. I mean, basically the religion was, if you had your political orientation correct, if, you know, the redness there, that your actions would automatically be just and righteous because, you know, you had your consciousness was raised. But it was so devoid of political content that when Mao fell from power and they sort of were, you know, adrift in the 80s, there was really almost nothing left to deal with. And people, you know, I remember there was a crosstalk, a famous crosstalk by Jiang Kun, a xiangsheng at the time. It was one of the only funny ones at the time. I wrote some articles about this on Dan Wei, as a matter of fact, where the premise of it was the guy falls into a tiger pit in the zoo, and he's about to be eaten by a tiger. And he's suddenly faced with thoughts of mortality, and what does he do at this moment when he's about to die? And the premise, the underlying premise of the whole joke is that he realizes he doesn't have any moral compass or any religious compass. He doesn't know what to – and he starts, you know, bargaining with the tiger. And he says, how do I pray? Is it to the Virgin Mary or to Jesus? I don't really – can't do that. And he starts saying, well, maybe I'll lay feng. He starts, applying to lay feng. And then he starts saying maybe it's the four modernizations. You know, if you save me, I'll not only work for the four modernizations, I'll work for the eight modernizations, or however many modernizations you want. And the joke was that here was this poor guy that he had been left in the 80s with nothing to stand on, with not even traditional Chinese values, because no one even knew what that was. So I think the problem is that Mao, it was a quasi-religious sort of system that had no moral or ethical content specifically. And so when it was even that was abandoned, then China's literally left with nothing, I think, in the 80s.
Right, but I mean, there are other countries in the world. There are other societies that have essentially gone without God and yet are not in any sort of state of complete moral collapse. I mean, it's possible
to be God,
to have
Kaiser. Doesn't
right,
have to
right,
be
exactly.
God,
but there are secular, sort of humanist societies. The UK, I would cite as one.
What's interesting about that is that in the UK, for example, there has never been a cultural break of the kind that China has experienced, I think not just once. Certainly 1949 was the big one. And you know, religion kind of grew in the UK and flourished, and in many other countries in Europe too, and then is slowly kind of quietly disappearing, dying, if you like. I mean, church attendance is dropping all over Europe very fast.
Yeah, it's becoming secular.
It's becoming a thing that old people do, young people don't. And so I think that to me, actually, religion ultimately, it's about culture. It's about the underlying culture behind it. And when you have, China was already in ferment before 1949. It was already urgently seeking for cultural meaning and identity, and who are we, and how do we go forward, and what do we adopt from the West and what don't we adopt. And when you then kind of break that again, you're kind of adding another layer of confusion to an already very to a real melting pot already. And I think it's, we're looking at many, many generations at this point of confusion about
you
meaning.
You put your finger on it. I mean, that's really what it is. It's the rapidity. And it's been compressed into this very, very short time frame. And thrown atop this are the exigencies of material wealth there. I mean, of fast growth. Everyone is sort of wang qian kan, right? So now money mad. I mean, that sounds extremely cliche, but I mean, that is the stark reality that we're facing here, right?
I think we can't, as observers of China, I think we can't argue with the fact that the Chinese themselves perceive this as a moral vacuum, no matter what we say, and that they've been clumsy at trying to address it. In the late 90s, suddenly the government started pushing this thing that they called 素质教育, moral education. And it was like, what's that? And if you say, well, lei feng, nobody believes in lei feng, and said, teaching traditional Chinese moral ethical values. And literally people had no idea what they're talking about, because those things had been so completely scrambled and expunged during the previous few decades.
I think it's very difficult when you have a government that is mendacious and often evil. I mean, in South Africa, where I grew up, we have a very big problem now that nobody really thinks that it's good to work to make money. So we have a lot of problems with crime. We have a lot of problems with corruption, and it's very understandable, because the country has never had a government that has treated its citizens decently. Never. Mm-hmm. We had a tiny, from when the history of South Africa was written, we had a tiny Dutch settlement, then a British settlement that expanded only when they found diamonds and gold, that abused the entire indigenous population.
Several,
11 basically. And then we had the apartheid government, which took that abuse to a science. They made it into a science. And now people talk about, why is there so much crime in South Africa? One of the reasons is nobody's ever had a good example. The government and business are not – the people you should look up to are people who have committed evil. And I think China has the same problem. Who do you look up to here?
Right. When you look up and you see a party that is rife with with corruption, when you see, you know, personal moral failings of
and you see the people who are successes, the top business people, the top actors and actresses, directors, are all sellouts, criminals, corrupt people. They're all people who have had to commit some kind of sin, basically.
It's pretty bleak there, Jeremy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is bleak. That's why China has this problem. It's not pretty, if you want to be honest.
Well, yeah, there's also another problem on top of all this, getting back to these viral videos and things like that. China has always had a moral problem throughout its history, and especially, you know, recently, in this sort of in having something to the equivalent that in the West we have, like public virtue, public morality, right, the Good Samaritan, the philanthropy that you see among your rich people. China doesn't have a tradition of that. China, you know, the U.S. is the Western culture is more like, you know, individualism, you know, an individualist kind of streak combined with a sort of a Judeo-Christian ethic that's supposed to say you're supposed to help everyone regardless of their status in life and this kind of thing. China is very different. It was, of course, very family. There was always this pull between communitarian kinds of forces, but also the other one is not the individual, it's the family.
Sure.
So there was never really a model. In fact, there was only one historical philosophical precedent in the Muozi, which is this concept of Jian'ai.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. And that's even a minor school that never really developed.
Right. Explain Jian'ai, this universal love concept.
That's universal love. Well, it's just similar to the notion of
love
for all mankind. You know, equally, regardless of whether you even know them. Right. This is something that's been absent in Chinese culture, and I think Chinese people sort of realize this, and when they see this. An American sitting down with a beggar, sharing his French fries and like talking to her. They see this and they suddenly spot that. It's just like, that's something our culture has never emphasized for us, has never even given us a model. Jeremy, you're talking about models. You know, there's no model of this. The model is sort of like you help your family, you help your friends with jianghu, you know, gumer, mm-hmm. right? But there's no model for just helping some random person on the street because that's not a precedent in Chinese society. And I think a lot of Christian people, the Chinese Christians you talk about, will point directly to that and say, you know, this is something I get from Christianity, even though Christians don't practice it either. But
David, you're a big reader of sociobiology and evolutionary psychology and things like that. And I think, you know, science these days, although some of these ideas are being challenged now, I mean, they're not quite as mathematical as we once thought they were. But essentially, altruism, as observed in nature, is dispensed sort of in very close proportion to genetic relatedness. Right. That would seem almost to conform with a Confucian idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
But okay, so what about, to leap here, to talk about Confucianism. Efforts to revive Confucianism, does Confucius offer anything of value to contemporary Chinese society? I mean, I'm quite enamored with certain Confucian ideas. I mean, the idea of Ren, mm-hmm. you know, humaneness, the sort of golden rule put in negative, you know, do not do to others what one would not want done to oneself. I think these are sort of wonderful secular guidelines that the sort that I teach my children. And what is the state of the Confucian revival? I mean, Didi, you've written on this before, right?
The state of the Confucian revival. I mean, it's so complicated. And again, I think this just all keeps coming back to the fact that there is no real freedom of speech in this country. Mm-hmm. So you cannot bring ideas out into the open and say, what is this? You know, can we actually talk about this openly, honestly, and fully? And therefore, you can never come to, you know, people are never really going to figure things out under those conditions because it's a kind of a miasma of kind of ignorance and partial meaning. And I think it's extremely damaging. But, I mean, the Confucian revival today is, I think, in to some extent linked to the concept of a 和谐社会, a harmonious society. And to me, that's, again, it's a question, it's about control.
You think that ultimately
it's about political
that's
control.
That's what I was going to say in answer to your question. I think it's not that it has some good for Chinese society, although it may have some, but I think the reason the government's pushing it is because it's advantageous to them. It's very hierarchical and
exactly.
It's based on this notion of harmony, which Chinese people, you know, it's like Americans, you scratch them, and what's the button you push? You know,
it's freedom,
right. Individual freedom. You know, with Chinese, I keep conflating Christians. And with the Chinese, it's harmony. You know, cooperation, harmony, avoiding conflict. At all costs, except when there's a revolution, right? And I think that the government's using that. There are some good things about Confucianism. I agree with you. But I mean, I don't think.
But it's a very unappealing life way of directing your life.
Right.
I mean, essentially, it's very patriarchal. It's obedience to authority. It's all the things that are extremely uncool.
Family.
It doesn't have a hope in hell of actually affecting any, even one person's morality in China, I would go to say.
This woman, Yu Dan, who's the rock star, the
popularizer.
Confucian preacher, has come as close as anyone, but she has been accused of watering it down and diluting it and changing it, and because precisely what you said. If she doesn't do that, it's a very dull.
Totally. It's like Hanahan says, you can talk all you want about silk and, the Guqin, but if people don't actually give a shit about silk and the Guqin, it's not ever going to become a lively part of contemporary Chinese culture.
I mean, Confucianism is one element of a bigger sort of picture, I think, that China had, a sort of a civil society, if you like. And I think that's a very, a civil religion, rather, I should say. And I think that's a very important concept here because it's just one strand. So yes, of course, some of its concepts are useful and interesting indeed. But, it's not a religion per se.
No.
And there are other elements that need to be brought in. And it was always a very delicate balance here, I think, because it was not a monotheistic culture. And that balance was absolutely blown apart, earlier in the last century. And people are still trying to unpick it, to put it back together, rather.
Early in the last century, Humpty Dumpty, fell from the wall. Were there efforts? Were all the king's horses met? I mean, the iconoclasts of the new culture movement. These were some real luminaries. They were some brilliant men. And as they sought to dismantle one civil religion, was there an effort being made? Did Chinese scientism, the religion, if you will, that they embraced, did that offer a value system, a moral system to supplant the one?
I really think they never got there because in 1949 something else happened and something took over, which was extremely dictatorial and simply told everybody what to do from then on, and with very little discussion, certainly very little meaningful discussion about anything that followed. And what you then had was almost a sort of a dark age in some ways. I mean, we have enormous death figures that began then.
You're talking about the 1949.
Yes, I am. Yeah, and the kind of the violence that began in the quest of creating, shaping a new society, that ultimately, if you like, failed. 1989 was perhaps the moment that marks that, at least symbolically, because after 89, what happened then was that basically everybody in the government, except for a few zealots, recognized that the system had failed. Mm. And what have we been left with since then? We've had a depoliticization, for better or for worse, and in that vacuum, people have been pushed towards money, towards materialism, etc., but still under an atmosphere of unfreedom in the sense that you still cannot really talk about what's going on here. And, until that shifts, I really see enormous problems in trying to put together any kind of civil religion that will provide meaning
for
society.
I mean, I think, in Beijing, you daily see the problem illustrated by the large numbers of very fancy cars with military plates or Jingbei plates or various government affiliations who just drive like complete pigs really, really dangerously. This is something you see every single day if you're on the streets in Beijing. How can this society ever hope to teach the ordinary person to be nice to somebody else when it's quite clear that the way to get ahead is to fuck everyone else over? And that lesson is brought home to you daily if you read the news, if you go on the street. And I don't think there's any religion or any way of thinking that can stop this until...
Well, I disagree with that somewhat. I mean, you're right in terms of the public models, but... The way I see it right now is that there has been a space opened ipso facto by the government, not actively but tacitly, with Buddhism. There's an enormous presence of Buddhism online. There are thousands of Buddhist websites. Every master has their own website. They have scads of DVDs and cyber materials out there, and it's a space. Everyone on, you know, the Weibo has thousands and thousands, maybe tens of thousands of Buddhist related sites, and it's a space that community can explore. And furthermore, they're exploring it in Beijing, in the big cities, with relative autonomy and very little interference. Christians a little bit less so. I mean, they're watched more carefully, but if you just look at how Chinese people are behaving. Never mind judging whether it's right or wrong, Jeremy. They're moving in that. They're moving in that direction.
When Chinese people get religion, you get the Taiping Rebellion, you get the Boxers, you get Falun Gong. I don't disagree.
I'm not saying it's good. I'm just not sure
it's aimed at reconstructing a moral fabric. I mean, I'm not sure it's aimed at stitching together the moral fabric. I think
that moral fabric is broader than religion, as we understand it, as religion per se. You know, a system of beliefs which you have to adhere to, which is how it's commonly understood. I think religion is a much, you know, it's in terms of civil religion, again, it's a set of beliefs and how they put together.
Well, when we think of the Protestant work ethic, that the Judeo-Christian, you know, these are terms we throw out. Actually, they're very vaguely defined, and we almost prefer them that way. And this is something China does not really have and hasn't had, which is why in the 90s this moral vacuum, it just went into materialism, right? And I agree with you, Jeremy. I think there's a real risk that you could get a Taiping Rebellion, or, you know, and the crackdown on the Falun Gong was precisely because they feared that kind of fanatical adherence to a religious cult. I'm just pointing out that it's a fact now that there are hundreds of millions of people who are exploring Buddhism and Christianity. And if you ask them why, and I've asked them, I've had interviewed lots of them, they will tell you that China needs this right now. We need a moral compass. Never mind whether it's a
moral compass.
Yeah, they think what we lack is a grounding for morality, because Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought it's not it, and Confucianism is empty, and we repudiated that a century ago. And what we need is something that has a spiritual basis. They will say that. And I think there's a risk with that. But on the other hand, when you talk to people individually, and you've interviewed these Christians, like you say, how do you find the strength?
Taoists,
you
know, it's my hermits. God.
And the same thing, I've talked to so many people who have said, Buddhism has just changed my life. I now am much nicer to my kids, my parents. You know, and you can't argue with that.
My mother-in-law was a notorious harridan before she found Buddhism. Now she's extraordinarily mild.
Oh. So in your personal life, at least, you have seen
and doesn't speak English, I hope.
No, anyway, go ahead. Harridan.
You mean anyway, a poor fool.
We should let me ask about moral philosophy in the academy. I mean, are there philosophy departments at Beida that are taking moral philosophy very seriously? Are there ethics departments that
are? There are. And
what's coming out of this?
Well, one of the things coming out of it is Buddhism. You have Buddhist monks giving talks at Beida at Peking University. There are Buddhist studies at Peking University. You have people who are professors who major in that and have students in that and get up and talk about Buddhism. They have, you know, fanatical followings.
So the Eightfold Path.
The Eightfold Path, right. There's a lot of Confucian scholarship. It's very open now. There are people at the Academy of Social Science who study that, have conferences on it, and it's pretty openly. Buddhism is quite visible now. It's on TV a lot.
Absolutely.
There are TV shows. There are living Buddhas that go on TV and on game shows even, or not game shows, but talk shows and, you know, give their opinions. So Buddhism, that's the point I'm making. The government, and I think there's a reason, we know there's a reason for that. There's reason to believe that Jiang Zemin may be a closet Buddhist, for one thing. There's a lot of reason to believe that a whole lot of party members are Buddhists. And we know that from not only anecdotal evidence,
true,
but just a lot of party members are Buddhists, a lot of CEOs, rich billionaires and stuff are Buddhists. But also the big secret is, and that's not a secret, Hu Jintao actually said this. He said, maybe the rise of Buddhism can help alleviate some of the conflicts because of income disparity and class, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they're actually looking.
Classic opium of the people.
Oh, the opium of the people? Yes, exactly.
Administer them a good dose.
This country just has an amazing capacity to make you even more cynical than you thought you were. It's extraordinary.
Didi, are you destroyed by cynicism?
I'm not. Well, I don't even know how to answer that. I mean, you know, how, but then how ultimately, and perhaps I am very cynical because I think, you know, the issue of power is very important. And you know, how ultimately does the Communist Party then openly, formally invite Buddhism into its folds, if you like. Now, I mean, we know it's happening, but it's kind of happening in a sort of a don't talk about it all too much kind of a sense. I mean, there is still an inhibition there from the party to do that.
I think the official thing is to allow it but not encourage it.
Exactly. I mean, we know there's all sorts of things that are happening here which are tacitly permitted. You can do it as long as you don't talk about it too much. That's the phrase, and it's a classic phrase here. But where does that leave people? That's what I want to know.
It exacerbates the problem, doesn't it? I mean, it's like this ridiculous kerfuffle about the PM 2.5 readings. Now, the vice environmental minister said, asked the U.S. embassy basically not to tweet their pollution their readings. Quality. I mean, you know, how can anybody in this society think that, have any moral compass when the government says, look, we're basically going to tell you that we're going to lie to you, and in fact, we're also going to tell you that we object to foreigners telling you the truth. That's coming from the government.
It's absolutely hilarious. The whole thing is just hilarious.
So, I mean, what are you going to do? Like all Chinese people,
you're going to be like,
I don't believe this bullshit, and I'm going to get my kid into school in Australia or Canada or the United States, and I'm going to buy imported milk powder, and I'm not going to help anybody because clearly nobody in the society is going to help me.
Jeremy, you're about to become a father. David, you've raised a child here. Dee Dee, you've got kids, young children, and I've got young children here. And in the case of Dee Dee's and my children, and in the case of your daughter, David, all products of Chinese education at the educational system. What do you make of moral education in Chinese schools?
That's a humdinger of a question, Kaiser. I mean, my swift response to that is, I think moral education has to happen at home. It doesn't happen at school. In fact, there are many examples of, I'm not saying that people don't try, and individual teachers do try. There are some very, very good teachers out there, very passionate and dedicated. But I personally know some situations in Chinese schools, and I've experienced one myself, where, in fact, because the school refused to admit that a terrible accident had happened on campus, the children were left with a sense that it's actually okay for a kid to be run over by a school car. And they felt very unsafe. The children felt very unsafe. And do you know what? That problem has never really been solved. And the issue was that the school refused to sort of fess up about what had happened, and they refused to come clean, and they refused to explain publicly because they had to maintain complete control over the situation.
My child attends that school and was a classmate, or not a classmate, but in the same grade as the child who was run over. And we, I think, all know his parents. My read on that was that this wasn't a response specific to Fang Caodi or the school in question. It was a Chinese response.
And Fang Caodi, the school in question, is part of the Chinese education system. It's a state school, and the education ministry here is extremely conservative. It's about top down control,
right.
And it's very, very tough on the teachers as well. And you know, it was just very remarkable. I'll give you a small example. I keep talking about civil religion. I think it's a fascinating concept because it takes religion out of, you know, a kind of a mumbo jumbo sort of thing that I think a lot of sort of rationalists or, you know, post Enlightenment people sort of where we feel it is or where they feel it is. And it puts it in a much more interesting place, which I think is both personal and social at the same time. There was a series of extremely angry parents' meetings at the school where there was at one point a threat from Chinese parents. Now, I'm not racially Chinese, so I'm quite sensitive to that fact, and I tend to keep a low profile in public situations. I kept a very low profile at those meetings. It was absolutely the Chinese parents who were leading, who were shouting and yelling and slamming the desks and doing all sorts of stuff with the school administrators. And eventually, we simply couldn't get any traction. We couldn't get them to accept that cars shouldn't actually be driving around on children's playgrounds in schools, that this was not an appropriate place to turn into a car park, that it's not appropriate to drive a car over a playground, because this is, of course, how this terrible accident happened, that a car drove over a child, with the driver believing that what he was driving over was merely, in inverted commas, a pile of coats. Now, why a driver would think it's all right to drive over a pile of children's coats is another question that needs answering as well. However, there was a child in that pile, and he was nearly killed. And, you know, ultimately, after many meetings, very angry meetings, the school administration came back and said, okay, we will meet this. We will agree to ban cars from playgrounds in the school, from driving over the playground. And another very, you know, burning issue was bullying. And it's simply, it's not dealt with terribly well here. And they came back and said, okay, we're going to make a set of rules. And here are the rules, numbers 1 to 10, whatever it was. The first rule was read out to us, and it was fervently love your country. Now, and we just sort of exploded in laughter. Yeah. And several people said, what does that have to do with bullying? And the reaction from the school authorities was, well, it has a lot to do with bullying. It's all about patriotism. And it just didn't match. It's like, what country are you living, what planet are you living in that you think that bullying between children in schools, which is after all a global problem, a worldwide problem, has got anything to do with loving the Chinese state and the Communist Party, because it's not going to solve your problem. So, and I think, you know, but these are the restrictions, obviously, that they're under.
That's very interesting that you bring that up, because there was a lot of internet, even on Weibo, there was some chatter about specifically that example you're giving, not with this school, but with someone had found had compared some instructions for children on how to be a good citizen or something in the classroom in the U.S. versus in China, mm-hmm. and it had precisely the difference that you mentioned. In China, it was this vague sort of stuff about, you know, being a good citizen and, you know, always acting in accordance with the rules of society and this and that. And the American classroom was things like, you know, pick up other people's stuff if they leave it out.
Very concrete.
If someone's if the forest is slippery, be sure and help people across it and remind them and all this kind of thing. Very specific, implementable moral goals that any kid could understand and do. And the Chinese stuff was this pie in the sky
stuff. Empty and it's formalistic. I think a lot of that comes from Confucian thinking, actually.
How Chinese people are. I mean, Chinese are inherently pragmatic people. And there's a lot of these disconnects.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking earlier. So Chinese people, best friends you could ever have at a personal level,
right.
You know, in personal friendships. But then that same person is a total
in public to other people.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They'll be extraordinarily rude to wait staff. They'll be what explains this? What explains the weird kind of hostility to the world around?
I think it's this deep seated, I guess you could say, moral kind of orientation. It's this cultural inertia that has led people to believe that the public space is one in which moral rules just don't apply. There's the family and there's friendships, and then there's your obligations to the state and this kind of thing. There's patriotism, but the public sphere just does not exist. So you can spit on the floor, you can spit on the sidewalk, you can ignore beggars, you can be rude to you know, random people that you don't know. And I think that's just something that China has got to start dealing with. And, you know, all the signs in the world and all the injunctions to, you know, study Lei Feng is not going to do it. And I think it's a deep sickness in society that hasn't been dealt with fully.
I really firmly believe this is not a Communist Party thing. I mean, I think Lu Xun,
It's a Chinese thing.
The depressing thing is, if you read the thinkers, and maybe Lu Xun is the most prominent.
Lu Xun, Boyang.
Or Lin Yutang.
Yeah, Boyang in the 80s.
Nothing has changed.
The ugly Chinaman.
It's not just the Communist Party.
That's right.
But the Communist Party has a very, very big responsibility for the fact that things are not going to change.
Right.
Because there is no good example in society. I mean, I don't have a kid yet, and I haven't actually had to face these playground and school issues yet. Mm. But one of the things that I'm quite frightened about is, to succeed in this society, you have to know how to cheat and lie and steal and f*** over your best friend. That is something I would say without any qualification. That is one way, and that is the main way you succeed in society in China at the moment. So to raise a child in this society, that is the survival skill you should teach them if you want them to thrive. That is my dilemma.
You know, I face the same problem. I know Bill Bishop and I have talked about this as well. You know, do we raise these sort of helpless naives who can't do xinyar in the world of the dog-eat-dog world of China right now? Or do we encourage them to be hard?
Well, there's one issue.
And what do you do, Kaiser?
Well, I think I've survived this long in China without a shred of that native cunning. And I think it's possible if you just sort of shelter yourself from it, as I...
You've got some special, like, Arizona fairy juice you sprinkle over your children at night.
Right, that's what I do.
There's one issue we should probably mention here, because I think it's relevant, is that this longstanding difference in the societies that China is usually considered a people-oriented culture, whereas the West is considered a law... governed, I guess governed is the right word.
That's a whole other kind of word.
Fajr. No, but it has to do because it relates directly to Jeremy's question. The way that people can survive in a society, in a cutthroat society, is the mitigating issue of a factor of the legal system, that people are protected by legal rights, even the weak, in a fully developed law culture of Fajr. Whereas in a culture like this, it depends on who you know. It depends on what you can. And the example I always give is just things like Beijing traffic. The fact that it's impossible to successfully cross the street unless you are a functioning, fully sighted, non-handicapped person. If you're
preferably aged, with a very aggressive streak.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's a human rights issue. The fact that it's very difficult to cross a Beijing street is a human rights thing, and it's a legal issue. The fact that this is not the people run red lights and they don't pay any attention to the traffic laws, and the result is this kind of society you're talking about. The weak, the frail, the old cannot survive in that environment. Okay. And that's a
special. Let me sound a little Marxist here, a little sort of deterministic here,
comrade.
I really think that a lot of this stuff is superstructure that is ultimately determined by economic realities. That this is a stage. Like, I mean, people would have used the same language to describe America in the 1870s or the 1880s, right? They would have. I mean, it was also the age of rampant robber baronry and all sorts of. I mean, society was full of charlatans. Everyone was out to get ahead and make a buck. And I think. I mean, I'm sounding a desperate note of optimism here, but I really believe that it may grow out of this.
I wonder because, I mean, that I don't know how far the comparison goes because China is an old civilization. It's been through many cycles of rise and fall. In a way, it's been where America was, if you like, because
even
America...
higher than America.
For example, yes. And it's already, it's been there, done that. In terms of wealth. I mean, China did used to be apparently the largest economy in the world. It may become that again. I mean, what that will mean is another question. But for Chinese people as well, for non-Chinese people. But I wonder, it's not like China is a sort of a new country in inverted commas as America was then. I realize that's also a contentious thing to say. But in terms of Western civil, Western culture arriving in the United States and when it did that and how it started to develop and build, but China's been here a long time, right here, and it's been rich before, and then everything fell apart. So I'm not sure that we really have a very close parallel there.
Well. I'm going to cling tenaciously.
You're going to cling tenaciously to your naive optimism.
That's right.
I think you have it both ways.
Classic American.
I think you're right. I think you have a good point. But I think there are also cultural proclivities or tendencies that kind of negate that. If you look at, Japan has subways too, just like Beijing does, and yet people wait in line at Japanese subways and they don't hear it. They're just as crowded there as they are here.
I think I'm seeing a lot of improvement in that regard.
That's right. But
I take
the
subway every day. I mean, and I see people dutifully get up and give their seats to the elderly and to the infirm and the.
But it shows. But it's the result of they've hired a lot of people to stand there and inculcate these civic or cultural values.
That might be what it takes, though, David.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm just saying Kaiser's right. Kaiser's right, but it's not just objective situation.
We live in a really time where we endure this. Yeah. Anyway, this conversation could go on for another hour, but we need to sort of wrap things up. So let's move on to recommendations. Who's got one to start with?
Well, I'll kick off because I've been talking about the concept of civil religion quite a bit. Robert Bella is an academic. A professor emeritus at one of the major Californian universities. He wrote a very interesting book called Religion in Human Evolution. And he does something fabulously interesting in that book. It's quite a quirky book. It's the fruit of many decades of scholarship. He's over 80 now. It's a strongly individual book. And he basically does exactly what I think is so interesting and important, is he takes religion out of its very narrow confines, which are all about, you know, control and power and systems and all this sort of stuff. And he says religion is rooted in human evolution. It's rooted in biology. It's rooted in the desire to form a society which is based on morals and not on violence. He has a in the blurb, which I read on the way over. I did read the book the end of last year when I wrote about it. In a column, he has, well, there is a great line. I don't know if he wrote it himself or if his publicist did. It says, make religion, not war. Kind of sums up the direction he's going in. And it's just fabulously interesting because it raises questions for every society. What is the civil religion? What are the set of beliefs that hold a society together that gives it identity, that makes it a good place?
And Didi, you've got a great piece that was written, and this is at the end of 2011, is that right? And we'll make sure to link to that piece where he talks to you specifically about China.
He does indeed, and he talks also about, you know, the problem of Mao and the fact he, you know, the parallel to the very violent kind of legalist first emperor who unified China, Qin Shi Huangdi was his entire name. And he says, you know, this when you behave like this, look at the society that grows out of this kind of behavior ultimately. And I think actually, you know, interesting. I can only recommend it. It is quite academic, but if you feel like a challenge, go for it. And it also, can I just add, it also doesn't. It looks at comparative religions, so Greece, China, India, Israel, very 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 broad sweep.
Great. That's the kind of book I love. I mean, I'm very, very eager to read that. Robert Bella. David.
Okay. I first want to add a recommendation that I forgot to do on the podcast we did with Victor Mayer. Mm-hmm. And I meant to do this because Victor is a good friend and everything, but I wanted to recommend his series of it's a journal, basically, that he edits called the Sino-Platonic Papers. It's at sino-platonic.org. And it's this really fascinating stuff, very diverse scholars, sort of independent scholars on everything from culture to language, you know, linguistics, characters, everything. It's very interesting. So that's one thing I wanted to add from last podcast that I did with Victor. But what I'd like to recommend for this particular podcast is a book, or anything by this person, but a particular book by Lucien Pai.
Yes.
Whose ability to distill these issues that we're talking about, deep issues of Chinese culture and Chinese DNA,
political culture,
culture is astounding. And right. the book that I've been that I peruse all the time is called The Mandarin and the Cadre, and it's a very perceptive book about the very issues we've been talking about, the deep seated tensions in Chinese culture.
Let me jump in there with Lucien Pai. One book that he wrote, which I thought was extraordinarily insightful, was he looked at the warlord system between 1916 and 1928, and he looked at it as a series of states you know, they were independent polities that were, and he derives from this a set of sort of rules of the game for the Chinese political culture. And it's really, I found that it's dead on. It's really dead
yes.
on. It's he's
deep.
He's very good. So he was at MIT.
Yes, he was at MIT. It's in print still. It's University of Michigan Press.
Okay, great. Jeremy, what you have?
A website called Marco Polo Project, which is started by a young Frenchman, Julian, in Melbourne, in Australia. And
not the Julian that speaks fabulously good Chinese.
No, a different Julian. He lives in Australia, not in China. Okay. But it's a multilingual translation project. So they're taking Chinese writings, fiction, nonfiction, criticism, essays from various interesting websites. And it's sort of an open source translation project. It's not newsy or it's not like some of the other translation blogs that are out there. A lot of it is non-newsy essays, but it's pretty good. And the translations are, most of them are at least in English and French, and there are also other languages. And they, you can, you know, if you're learning Chinese, it's a good resource because
great.
They put the Chinese side by side the foreign language.
The Marco Polo Project. Well, it sounds like a lot for one guy to take on.
He has a few people working with him.
Okay, yeah. Really good, really good. I've got a couple of things. One, I just want to shout back at Laszlo Montgomery for the Chinese History podcast.
I listened to that.
Yeah, you know, he's actually mentioned us a couple of times on
really?
The show, and I wanted to shout back at him. He's It's terrific. It's quirky. It's a one man show. He gets on there and he talks about Chinese history. I was listening recently to his 3-part series on the Cultural Revolution.
It's I thought it was 4-part actually.
4-part.
I think it's another part. Yeah, it's quite I'm good. A fan too.
Yeah.
Hi, Laszlo.
Hi, Laszlo. And thanks for all the plugs you've given to us. I also wanted to recommend Understanding China's Political System, which is an excellent guide to the Chinese political system. It was authored by Susan V. Lawrence and by Michael F. Martin for the Congressional Research Service. It's really the best, nice, short-form summary of the political system that I've yet come across, and you've definitely got to read it if you have a chance. It's available online. We'll put a link to it on the podcast page and on our Facebook page. So, Jeremy, thanks again. I hope that next week you won't be here because you'll be passing out cigars. But
we'll see.
We'll see. David, thanks again.
Amitofu.
Didi, thank you for coming. It was
my
great
pleasure. Thank you.
Kaiser, all hail Satan.
Thank you. And
his religion.
Yeah. Hail Satan.
All right. Take care. We'll see you next week.